A63, number 17B.
All right. So, here we feel, you see, the command is to the listener, come on to me. I am the one. Huh? Turn to me. I'm the one. Just as you have felt it. However you expressed it, it is therefore just a question of accentuation. So, we have therefore as an attitude of the reader would be here that he says, oh, I see, the very first thing I have to know that not I, the student, can solve the situation. Not I have the intelligence to solve the situation. Not I have the power to solve the situation and to get out of the mess. What shall I do in order that I get out of the mess? I have to go to the one mind. See, the first day is always to turn to God. Turn to the I that can do it. To the I am that can do it. So this is perhaps the most difficult one in all the seven statements of the commandments to interpret rightly or to accentuate rightly. Yeah. Yes?
I wanted to ask a question so that I make sure that I understand what you're saying. In the message, that you look first to see where the word is the Christ, in other words, is speaking, before you go on to see where mind is speaking.
Exactly. You see, that I think the great point of text interpretation, that one does not start with a single sentence and then begins to interpret it. We have established that over the years, that in order to interpret a single sentence, you first have to have an overall view of the whole subject. Here, all the commandments. Only when you have an overall view of the commandment, you get the leading idea. You get the leading idea here. It always has to do with the command that God puts on the student and that the commands which we have to obey. Then you have established the leading idea. Yeah. So always do that. Never start interpreting anything by just taking a sentence or a verse or a paragraph and then say, now I start interpreting it. It will always be wrong. You have first to see what place value a single sentence or verse has within the whole subject, or else we cannot interpret it rightly. As here, you have to read them all, and you get the tonality first of the biggest category. See that interpretation is a question of being able to have to see hierarchies of subject. Do you know what this means? I think we have been talking in earlier years a lot about it, that we always have to start from the highest hierarchy, that is, from that leading idea that covers the broadest subject, and then from there go to the second level, the second state in that hierarchy, which takes in a smaller section and smaller and smaller and smaller until you come down right to the smallest part, so that the smallest part is always interpreted from the consciousness of the overall writing idea. That's the hierarchical text interpretation, which is something that naturally has never been seen and never been trained in the Christian Science movement. Quite to the contrary, they have done the very opposite. They have said you can take any sentence out of the textbook and read it separately. That's what you do with the Bible lessons. You take all the various statements out of context and interpret them out of context. The very opposite of what we should do. And therefore people say, but Mrs. Eddy instituted those lesson sermons. Yes, she did it 100 years ago. Well, did we 100 years ago also know something about going on the moon and about computers and things like that? We didn't. We all went first through the nursery school, and we played with toys, and that was very good. And the more the children can play with toys, the better. But they will not play with toys after 10 years, and not after 50 years, and not after 100 years. And Mrs. Eddy had to give what, at that time, in that nursery school age, she had to give what people could understand. But not today. It's just hideous to think that this should be the teaching of today. This was the teaching of yesterday. And therefore she made the provision in the manual that you could, that one could change those lesson sermons the moment the time would be right to do so. Nobody talks about that the manual says that. They all sweep it right under the carpet so as to keep the whole field in absolute ignorance. And just go on with stating single sentences. You can't get anywhere with that kind of stuff. So, you're right, huh? It makes it, absolutely, you see, it makes it a science because then you put the detail into the whole. Huh? Yes, and then alone you can have a structural sense of it, a holistic sense of it. There where the gestalt comes in that you say every part must reflect in some way the characteristic of the whole. Here you have it very different, clearly, huh? At this very sentence here, this very statement of the first command, of the first statement of the commandment, in order to be interpreted aright, it must have the characteristic of the whole. Therefore, it must have the characteristic that it is a demand to the reader. And the way you have been, or you have quoted at the beginning, there that was missing that characteristic. You see? Yes? Yes, yes. The very same statement, put in another different, you could put it very easily into the Christ order. Huh? Then you would accentuate differently. Huh? And you would say, I'm the Lord that led you out of Egypt, huh? Out of the house of out of bondage. Huh? I led you. Huh? That's the power of the Christ that did it. Huh? Whereas here, in a different connotation, the very same has a different interpretation. That's a great point. That's why I still think that the movement has never been able to read the textbook properly, rightly, because they never could interpret the textbook in a structural way, in a holistic way, always in an atomistic way. Therefore, it never makes sense. And that's what she says and what we'll see next week when we take the chapter Some Objections Answered. Her whole tonality in there is that she says, don't take any sentence out of context. You must always have every leaf of a tree right, combined with the root of the tree, with the trunk of the tree. You must go from one great root, or the explanation of the details make no sense. She even says, then they appear contradictory. So, I'm glad you brought that up. It gave us a little side remark on text interpretation, which is so good, so necessary. Yeah. So here we have the demand of mind that says, turn really to the divine mind. Know that it is the divine mind that does lead you out of trouble. We come to the second statement. What does the second commandment mean for us?
It means that we should separate correctly.
Yeah. Would you first state what it says and then the interpretation so that we know that?
Well, it says that thou shalt have no other gods before me.
Yes, yes.
So the demand there would be to rely on a spiritual standpoint instead of a material standpoint.
Yes, yes. Uh-huh. How would somebody else explain it? Just always in various different words, bringing out the same tonality. Yes. What is the attitude, the command? Separation itself, yes. Uh-huh. Does he talk about the separation?
No, I think the demand is to separate oneself from other gods.
From other gods, yes. All right, yes. Yes, Pat?
He also had no other gods before me.
Before me, you would put the accent of me, huh? Yes, I'm the only god, all right. That means that we should not have other gods besides the one god. Which is that one god he refers to? What do you do in the second step? You always, huh? See, you have a flow. You don't have isolated statement. It refers back to the first, huh? Says, they said, you know, I'm the one, huh? Therefore, don't go to another than me, huh? See, you try always to see the connections, huh? Or you have no sequence. You see, if we don't make bridges from one to the next, we have just statement one next to the other without an order. See? Order only comes and sequence only comes when there is a flow from the one to the next and to the next and to the next. That's the interlinking. Only in that way we get the sequence. Or else you just have an accumulation of statements. So the demand is, now look here, if you want to be saved, what should you do? If you want to come out of Egypt and out of your mess, what should you do? What is the demand on you? It says, you have not to turn to yourself, you have to turn to the Lord God. He will do it, not you. Okay, then the second point comes as a demand and says, and if you do that, be careful that you are not vacillating and try to go from time to time to other gods. Don't really speculate with another god. Huh? Just know that I'm the only one and there is nothing beside me, and so you better turn to that one and only one. Huh? You can say, I therefore rely on it, or whatever you can expound, which is not in the text, but which would be in that tonality. So it gives you a very fine sense. See, you can also see now how important it is that we take that first statement in and not consider the second statement, like thou shalt have no other gods before me, as the first commandment, as theology does. If that is the first commandment and says, thou shalt have no other god before me, we don't know what that god is. We don't know what he's going. Perhaps he's going to hang you. Hmm? Or because he's going to send you right to hell. Hmm? You don't know what kind of god he is. But if you have the first statement, you know what kind of god he is, to which you have to turn as the only god. It is that God who says, you see, I'm the one that can do it. I'm the Christ power. I can do it. I will do it. You can rely on that. So we must have a real good basis first in mind and say, here is a basis. Here that basis is that there exists really a power that can lead you out of the mess, the Christ power. Therefore, as a command, go to that power. As the second says, therefore, don't really vacillate, don't be distracted. Just see that this is the only possibility and there is no other possibility. That's the second. The onlyness, the exclusiveness. Huh? So you can see these 7 days always repeat themselves, only in different shadings, but they still always have that common denominator. First, mind, I'm going to do it. Second, this is the only one. Huh? Yes?
In a way, Max, it covers the entire textbook, doesn't it, that second commandment?
Well, it's a favorite one, yes. Well, I think the other commandments also cover quite a bit, because mind is all over the textbook too, as the saving power. Huh? Yeah, well, everybody can have it. It's a favorite one, really, because... But I think she said it's a favorite one because that's the stumbling block usually. See, I think the first one is not the real stumbling block for people. They all like to be saved. That's not the great stumbling block. They all say, golly, I would like to get out of the mess. But how? There comes the favorite one. She said, you know, you can't do that with an impure consciousness. You can't do that if you have two powers, two causes, two gods. You can't do that. And there is usually the stumbling block, huh? That purity of reliance on the one and only mind. Then we come to the third statement. What does the third statement say? Perhaps we do it like this. We first say what the Bible says, even if it's not exactly, and then the spiritual interpretation and what it means for us. Yes? Yes, the third? Yes, Louis? Yes? Thou shalt not make any graven images, yes? And perhaps here we may go through a bit further what it says, because it's interesting about the graven image of what, huh? How does it run on? Yeah, you read it, yes. Yeah.
Or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above, or that is in the earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth.
Yeah, so, you see, he says that they are, don't make any graven image, huh? On all the levels. Huh? For them, they had, so to say, three levels. Heaven, earth, and Sheol, huh? The hell. Huh? What is beneath? The earth was, for them, Sheol, their hell. Huh? The underworld. Huh? So he takes in all those three layers of levels that they were conscious of heaven, earth and hell, and said, make no graven image, make no false likeness. Now, what does it mean spiritually? Why is it so? It's identification, huh? You, of God, yeah. Therefore, idolatry, huh, is always a false identification. And actually, when you know the Bible and the structure of the Bible, as John Dolley has shown it, you will always see that if the Bible comes to the point of describing idols and worshipping idols, that it's always at the point of soul, because it's making a false identity. Huh? It's a humanly built-up identity. That's the idol. Huh? And so, at that point, we have a sense of soul which says, don't make in your consciousness any false identity. Any false identity about all three levels. Is that important? What would be the false identity of heaven? When have we an idolatry sense of heaven? In practical life, beg your pardon. And they have no order. Heaven is order, yes. Yeah. 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 Don't you think it's much simpler than all that, that it says, don't make yourself a graven image of that of God. He is in heaven. For them, God was in heaven. Don't define God wrongly. Huh? Have a true definition of God. That's your definition of God. Don't make a wrong definition of what is on earth. What is on earth? For instance, don't make a wrong definition and false image and likeness what is on earth. What is on earth? Yes? Don't make a false definition of men and call a mortal an immortal. Or call the idea of man a mortal. Don't make that. So we have to see that we have to identify also the ideas rightly. The idea of man, for instance. So that we have not a distorted sense of the ideational universe, making it a illusive universe. So again, define your ideas of the seven synonymous term rightly. What is make no graven image of what is in the waters under the earth. Now we come really to something important. Where do we have an idolatrous sense of the waters beneath the earth, in Sheol, in hell? Error? The whole realm of error, don't identify that wrongly. How do we identify error wrongly? For instance, just give a few examples.
Time, place, or person?
Yeah. Well, you would identify error wrongly if you would say that error is real. Wouldn't you call that the false identification? That error has power, that error has law, that error has dominion. All what you do, what you say about error, about mortal mind, therefore it is that realm of the counterfeits of God. Sheol is the counterfeit of heaven, therefore don't have a wrong sense, a false identification of all that belongs to that whole realm of error, which is naturally terrific, so that we don't call mortal mind, mind. That we don't call matter reality. That we don't call the testimony of the physical senses as reliable. You see? It's the whole erroneous system of reference that is here under consideration. So, we have what we do in Christian Science. In Christian Science, we really, in our study, what do? We begin to identify rightly heaven, earth, and Sheol, what is under there. That we do. We identify first rightly what is God. Then we identify rightly what is his creation, man and the universe, the ideas. And then we identify rightly what are the counterfeits. And the world does not agree with our definition of the counterfeits. The world says, no, matter is real. Matter has power. Matter has laws. And we say, no. You see? So our whole teaching is that third statement, which now begins to redefine and properly define what is in heaven, what is on earth, and what is under the earth, in hell. Yes?
Would be correct to relate this also to the first, second, third degree?
Yes, you can. Yes, you can. Yeah. Yes, you can relate that. Yeah. So, here we have another commandment, that we should identify rightly everything. Right from God, right down to the devil. And redefine devil, us, and hell. We come to the next statement of the commandment, the fourth. What is the biblical text? What is the metaphysical interpretation? Yeah, this is now an interesting one. It has to do with principle. What is the biblical text? Alone to take the biblical text is already quite a problem. What does the biblical text say?
Showing mercy unto thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments.
Yes. Yes, you see, I was just wondering, because as you read it, you nearly dropped the last one, huh? And just added it quickly, though, that it is complete. But really, what really impressed you is that which is not the main point, namely showing mercy unto thousands of them, huh? That we like, showing mercy unto thousands that, to them. But the point is, who love me and keep my command. That's the command. Can you see again, if we know first the overall category of the commandments as the word of Christ, then we look out really to stress when we read it or when we think about it, we accentuate the word of the Christ and not the other terms. Actually, and here you have it very neatly, see, that the human mind says, oh, this is jolly good. After all, God is not such a bad boy that always cracks the whip. He also shows mercy unto thousands. Oh, that's nice. And one nearly forgets that really the real stuff of the commandment comes now. Those that love me and keep my commandments. See, that's the demand. To love me and keep my commandments. Yes. Obedience. Those who obey. Yes. Yes.
I don't think you can beat your epitome on this.
No.
Obedience to principle brings demonstration.
Yes. That's my epitome. Thank you. I don't know any more my compendiums, but you know it better. Yes. That's it. Yeah. So that the demand of obedience will bring demonstration, will bring the mercy down from God. Yes. All right, we make a break here.